Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Pauper or princess? Do you tell your kids what they might be inheriting one day? Great question. We'll talk about it with Sammy Dweck. He is the founder and CEO of the Family Office Doctor. He'll talk about why it's important to have that conversation and how to start it. And how do you invest in cryptocurrency? Well, I mean, there are way more ways than there were even just a year ago as this word, this investing idea really resonates in the zeitgeist. Exchange-traded funds, closed-end funds, robo-advisors, digital wallets. These days, it's actually way easier than you think. Dale Roberts is from Cut the Crap Investing. He takes us through the ins and outs of investing in cryptocurrency. Then credit card and debt, it's a bit of a tough mix. But when it comes to collecting points, there actually could be some advantages here, provided the points you earn are going to groceries or things that you need versus things that you want. Vanessa Bowen is the founder of Mintworthy, and she's going to talk about balancing this push for points with the destruction of your debt. We'll also talk to personal finance expert Laura Adams about her podcast, Money Girl, and Jessica Robinson takes us through her book, Financial Feminism, A Woman's Guide to Investing for a Sustainable Future. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Teenagers have been investing in cryptocurrency for years now. I know because my nephew was in crypto long before I even really knew what it was. Early adopters who got in at the beginning, many have made a killing. But what about the people who didn't? They missed the boat, or is the boat still here and it just is leaving on its next journey? If yes, if you believe the boat has more geography to cover, how do you go about it? How do you get into cryptocurrency? Dale Roberts is the founder of Cut the Crap Investing. He's here to talk a bit about the why he feels crypto is a smart move, but also about the how. How do you go about doing that? Hello, Dale.
Hello, Bruce. Thanks for having me back on.
You wrote a piece on your blog with the headline, "Investing in Bitcoin is a No-Brainer." How on earth can you possibly defend a headline like that?
And again, that's for me, as I put in the asterisks, right? Obviously, yeah. Everybody's going to make up their own choice. Two reasons for that is, A, I mean, there's the returns, right? That is part of it, but that shouldn't be the most important part, though. I mean, who can deny that when you see the returns, you know, year by year and over time, what it can do for your portfolio for just putting in a very modest amount. That is part of it. Now, go back to the main reason that I own it is for what it is. And to me, that is more than a currency, is that is digital gold or modern gold. Mm. So, I mean, that's the number one reason, right? And I hold gold as well. So,
yeah, you call it a store of value like gold, but gold is physical. You can sell it. If you own physical gold, you can make earrings and rings. Right. It is backed by central banks. It has got hundreds and hundreds of years of history here. Yeah. Why would you believe that Bitcoin is a store of value?
Because really, it comes down to trust, right? You might look at gold. What is gold? It is a shiny hunk of rock, right? It has value because enough people have trust in it and assign that value. It is no different than Bitcoin in that regard, and the fact that there's trust in it. There's trust in the people behind it and the whole community, if you will. And there's trust, if you will, in the security of it. Many like it myself because it's absolutely scarce and finite, right? There will only be 21 million Bitcoins created. Okay,
but I've got to just interrupt here. How can you be confident in that? Because governments can print money, new gold can be mined. Why can't you change the limit on Bitcoin or launch another parallel cryptocurrency like any of the ones that have arisen in the past, and all that gets muddied in it and it ceases to be finite?
Right. And there are, as you know, there are many other cryptocurrencies or crypto-like assets that have been created, but there is only one Bitcoin. There will only be 21 million coins because it is written. Because it is so, right? That is the mandate.
Sounds like the Ten Commandments. A lot of people cheat on the Ten Commandments.
Exactly. And we're coming down to that trust, right? And you know, it was created with that in mind, to be that store of value, to be outside, to be off the grid, right? So nobody wants to undo its greatest strength. And again, it's you're going to have on the grid and off grid, And for many of us, again, I'll hold the real gold, I'll hold the new gold, but we want that store of value, especially with, you know, what's going on today. If we look at modern monetary theory or modern monetary madness, I mean, it couldn't align any better for Bitcoin, right?
You say 6% is about how much you should have in terms of Bitcoin exposure. Why six?
That is an optimal. Again, that was done by a study to date, if you will. I went in for about 5%. A lot of that were gains real quick as I put in 2%. Of course, 2%, 3% became 6% and 7%. I'm happy at the 5% level for a portfolio weighting because it's kind of like a gold on steroids, if you will, right? It's a super gold. Now, again, past performance and all that doesn't guarantee future returns. But again, because it is so volatile on both sides and so explosive, you don't need that much, right? And I put some stats in that post on why it's a no-brainer, that even if you invest in 2, 3, 4% historically, I mean, you're talking about adding a 4, 5, 6, 7% to your total portfolio. For just putting in a small amount, that's the risk return proposition.
Do you think of yourself as an investor in Bitcoin or a trader of Bitcoin? Because I think there's a lot of people out there who are trading it.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, those would be weak hands, right? I'm looking at this as an asset, as any other asset, if you will. Not going to trade it, going to treat it like a portfolio asset. And I'm just going to trim it. So I have a schedule, like it's 5% now. When it goes to 10%, at that point, I will start trimming.
So Dale, you've written about crypto and Bitcoin for your site. You've also done a great piece on moneysense.ca. I want to get into the how here, because there are a bunch of different ways. One that is kind of fresh and new are these exchange-traded funds. So there's Purpose, there's Evolve, there's CI. What's the cost difference between a closed-end fund and an ETF? And what are the other things that one should know about comparing the two?
Sure. So the closed-end funds, I believe in the area about 1.8 or so, the ETFs are cheaper, that's for sure. Again, right now we know the management expense, but we don't know the total fees, right? Because there will be the fees for trading, if you will, and managing it. I would think in the end, though, I believe CI is the cheapest at 0.4. And in the end, with scale, I think that will still be the cheapest way at it. And I would think they will make the closed-end funds obsolete. So again, it really is good value. And, you know, we'll see what the total MER is. It might be low 1%. But that is a very cost-effective way to own it.
Wealthsimple has a crypto platform. Tell us about the robo-advisors and how they're getting into this.
Well, again, I believe, and again, on the robo side, if you want Wealthsimple, that's a unique offering for sure. And the only one that is now on board or on side with regulations, if you will. There's a lot of new regulatory movements going through. I've penned on that as well. So that is a good thing, too, for investors as well, right? It should gain some trust knowing that the regulators are overseeing. There'll be some good and some bad in there, but it is a unique offering at Wealthsimple. And I don't have an account there for the Bitcoin, if you will, or the other Ether, I believe they have as well. But I do talk to people who have it, and they say it's very, very easy to trade and hold, and they're big fans of it. So it's just another route in.
Yeah. So we've covered ETFs, closed-end funds, Wealthsimple or robo. Do people still, I mean, people who are investing, not trading, are digital wallets still a thing?
Absolutely. And again, once again, there's that saying, if you know, it's not your keys, which you, again, how you access and store and use your Bitcoin, not your keys, not your Bitcoin. So many are, but I think as we're seeing, you know, the movement for the, let's say, the typical or average investor, and will be through the ETFs, right? Because most people, they don't want to get a hard wallet or a cold wallet and store all their keys. A lot of stuff can go wrong with that as well. Right? You hear the stories of people owning a few Bitcoin and they go, I lost it because I lost my keys, right? So most do not want to go through that. And we saw in 1 month, I believe it was February, about 14% of all new additions to ETFs in Canada were Bitcoin ETFs, right?
Wow.
So you can see that. The mass adoption, really, it's going to, for the, let's say, the retail investor, even when, you know, a lot of advisors and other mutual fund managers start using it, it looks like it will be the root of the ETFs.
What are the risks? I mean, clearly, it's every investment is playing around with the relationship between risk and reward. What are the risks that investors should be aware of?
Right. obviously the risks are great, right? For me, again, it's just my opinion. The fact that it will become a major and widespread accepted asset, that is a done deal, in my opinion. That's done, but the risks are still there. I think the greatest risk is what it fights against is governments, government agencies, fiat dollars and stuff, right? Anytime any fiat has been in trouble in the past with the dollar, they've banned gold and such, right? Like they will go after it. That's a tough one, if you will. Obviously the risk even just on, you know, it could be hacked in some way, even though the blockchain has never suffered any major attack, if you will. And again, on that post for Money Sense, it explains that you can't really kill the blockchain, right? It is a series of transactions that have been stored. It's like having millions of bankers and auditors at the same time process that same execution, if you will, and it's stored around. So you might be able to destroy the short-term memory, but not the long-term.
Now, what about the risk of a massive pullback? Because when you look at the long-term chart of Bitcoin, sure, it is up at ridiculous highs today, but it did suffer a massive pullback.
Absolutely, absolutely. These days, I mean, we're seeing it's trading in a pretty good band. So there's not a lot of weak hands. But I think, again, that's the difference between, like, you had stated there, Bruce, like, are you a trader or are you an investor, right? We're going to find out the investors are going to be the holders that are going to stay in. The people are there for the quick money. If they stop making quick money, they're going to sell, right? So I think we have a combination of weak hands and long-term holders, and that's still to be seen, right? But lately, I mean, we suffered a pretty good, maybe it was a 20% or more, 25% pullback over the last few weeks. It rebounded quite quickly and is now on another uprising, if you will. So, I mean, that was a pretty good test for it, if you will. But again, yeah, I mean, the chance of, we should be prepared for, you know, stocks, we might be prepared for 40, 50. We should be prepared for that 70 and 80 that happened again, I believe is in 2017 into 2018, right? That could surely happen. The folks that I talk to that know that the trends in the story much better than I would say there could be like 4 or 5 cycles to this over the next 20, 30 years.
Right. When you say 70 to 80, do you mean a pullback of that magnitude?
Yeah, that's possible. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it.
I mean, and we know how investors are. There's like weak hands at 20%, 30%, 40%. Like how many would stay in if there really was a pullback in the 50% area, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We'll find out who's in for the reason of holding it as an asset in a digital gold.
Yeah, I think then they'll question whether it's actually a good store of value if it drops in half.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? Store of value, that's a tough definition because as we said, it's so volatile. So how could it be storing it?
Yeah.
I think we have to look at that store of value over the, you know, 5 years and 10 years and 15 years. That said, the reason for holding it with, you know, the printing of money and borrowing of money, that is what strengthens it, right? And that forced the sort of the new condition of MMT where they'll state openly that there's no cost to governments borrowing money these days. In my mind, that's pretty scary. Right. And I want to hedge that. I would suggest readers to look at Greg Foss on Twitter. He's a credit expert, a bond expert in Canada. And he would just say, really, it's default insurance on a basket of fiats.
Right.
And I think fiats, it's a wonderful description.
I assume you're not talking about the fiat, the automobile.
No.
Okay.
Fiat currencies, of course.
Dale, thank you for your time and your insight today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Bruce. Thank you.
Dale Roberts is the founder of Cut the Crap Investing. He was talking about investing in cryptocurrency, Bitcoin in particular, and there's a bunch of different ways. He talked about the ETFs, the closed-end funds, robo-advisors, and even the digital wallets. He writes as well for moneysense.ca, so check that out.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
700 episodes. Isn't that ridiculous? Like, that's more episodes than Grey's Anatomy, I think. Well, we love meeting other personal finance experts from all around the world. And we have an opportunity to do that, to speak to the host of a podcast called Money Girl that is almost at 700 episodes. Her name is Laura Adams. She joins us from Vero Beach, Florida. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce, how are you?
700? That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a lot. I've been podcasting every week since like 2007, 2008 is when Money Girl started. So yeah, they rack up quickly when you do them every week.
So you tape them on an 8-track tape or something like that back in the day. DVD, right. Something like that. tell me about your audience, first of all. Who are you talking to? I mean, Money Girl is very evocative, but I wonder what it evokes for you.
Yeah, that's a great question because I think a lot of people assume it's just women and it's not. It's actually 50-50 men and women.
Really?
Yes. And it's also a very wide age group. I mean, I've got folks in college who are looking forward to what do I do when I get my first job, all the way up to folks who are nearing retirement and are either trying to play catch up or just trying to make sure they're going to have a comfortable future. So it's a wide range of folks.
There are now 13,000 personal finance podcasts out there. I made the number up, but I'm probably not far off. Back in the day, there were not 13,000. What got you into this in the very beginning?
Yeah, it's really I have a passion for money and really explaining some pretty complex topics to folks in simple ways. And so I started doing that through podcasting and blogging. And then I got involved helping companies and really doing more PR work. I was writing, I got some book contracts and that led to doing media. That led to working with brands as a communicator for them and trying to help them explain complex topics like insurance, retirement, taxes, helping them get a good positive message out to consumers who really just need some basic answers and they want it in, an easy to understand language without all the jargon. So that's kind of in a nutshell how I started doing it.
Yeah. I mean, when you scroll through the topic episodes that, should you buy a car with cash or get an auto loan? What's the best type of mortgage? 5 tips to set better money goals. Very clear and compelling, relevant content. From your personal perspective, what are the topics that you just love that you could like dig in on every single week? And what are the topics where you're like, ugh, I know I need to talk about that, but I really, really, really don't want to talk about that.
Yeah. Well, for me, insurance, it might seem like a boring topic and it can be, but I love it because I've worked in it. I do. I've worked in it.
So you get it.
I get it. I've worked in it for so long and I truly understand what can move the needle on saving money. And a lot of people just buy insurance like auto insurance because they have to have it. And they're not really kind of wringing the rag and making sure that they're getting the best for the least price. I've worked with a variety of companies right now. Autoinsurance.org is a company that I'm working for where you can get free quotes. Like they're just tools. They're great tools that you can save money. And a lot of people don't know about that. So I do love that just because it helps people save money. I love retirement because, we all want a comfortable retirement. I also really enjoy talking about credit. That's just a foundational part of having a healthy financial life. I don't like taxes so much. I mean, that's kind of dry and boring.
Yeah.
Although it's just definitely necessary. And business, small business is amazing too. I am a small business owner and person. Mm-hmm. So that's, kind of a passion for me. My latest book, Money Smart Solopreneur, is all about building a business for yourself and building a financial future that is secure. So those are all the topics that I love. But yeah, I could probably do without taxes.
Yeah, I could do it without taxes too. But you cover insurance for me and I'll take all the like this oogly boogly woo-woo self-actualizing stuff. I'll do that for you. Perfect. Done. Now tell me, you have been at this a while. What are some things that you would say have changed in the fullness of time? I love that I heard a landline ringing because I haven't heard a landline ring since 2010. So hooray for you for being all retro with a landline. What are some things that have changed?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, speaking of business, that's something that's huge. More and more people are looking to create self-employment income, be it, you know, out of a need of income or just wanting to diversify their income, which I really love. And so I'm finding more people are willing to kind of stick their toe in the water of self-employment, whereas, you know, maybe 5, 10, 15 years ago, it was a little bit more foreign to them. Now, with so many apps and abilities just to easily do gig work, I'm finding that more people are coming to me with questions about self-employment, which is why I ended up writing the book. So I love that. And I do think that younger people are more on board with investing sooner, whereas before it was kind of like you had to twist people's arm to invest. Now young people, they get it. They look at the numbers and they realize they got to save aggressively to reach their retirement goals.
What is your take on this renewed interest in trading individual stocks? Because I've been around for a long time. I was a markets reporter for a long time in the dot-com boom and bust. So I've seen these cycles. I've seen the euphoria. I've seen the euphoria fade in 14 seconds. And this activity worries me. It worries me when people are playing the game like it's a game. What about you?
I totally agree. It is not solid investing. It truly is more gambling, just rolling the dice. And I get the appeal. I mean, for people who have a little extra money in the bank, it seems like an easy way to maybe make some money, but it's also a really easy way to lose some money. Mm. And, you know, I've been in that game many years ago. I did a little bit of day trading for a while. And, you know, for me, it was really a wash. I lost about as much as I made. And so I realized it was a waste of time and that being diversified was a much more profitable and easy way for me to invest. So I'm sold on diversification and, you know, just mutual funds, index funds. I really do think for the majority of investors, that's the way to go.
Okay. I'm going to ask you one last question here. If you could snap your fingers and change one behavior in society at large, when it comes to personal finance, even though it might put you and I both out of business because no one would want to hear from us because everybody would see, oh, so amazing with their money. What behavior change would you be a catalyst for?
Yeah, I think automation is just key. This is why 401ks work so well. The money is automatically moving into those into that account while you are sleeping. You know, you don't even have to think about it. So I think more automation would set people up for a better future. So I would say if you've got the opportunity to, you know, participate in a 401k and add to it that escalation each year where it's automatically rising and giving you a little bit more of your elected contribution each year. That's such an easy way to make sure you're going to do well.
I'll just do a little translation for our Canadian listeners. 401k equals RRSP. Basically, not the same, a similar retirement savings vehicle, catalyst by the governments in both Canada and the US to get people to save more. We just call it something different up here.
Thank you.
No problem. No problem. If you'd spoken Spanish, I would have been less able to do the translation. But when it comes to money jargon, I used to live and work in the US. So I'm familiar with some of the things that we talk about down there. Laura, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. It's been great to connect with you and your audience.
Thank you so much. Laura Adams is the host of Money Girl, personal finance podcast that is now approaching 700 episodes. Amazing. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, using your credit card points to tackle your debt. I don't know. I feel a little conflicted about this strategy. Vanessa Bowen from Mintworthy will be here to talk about how to do that. And later, how to tell your children about their future inheritance. Some young people can expect a big boffo nest egg. Should you have that conversation now? Should you have it later? When should you have it? And if you have missed an episode of Moolala, it's very simple to go pick up where you left off. We are on all the podcast platforms, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon, all those. So go to wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can download the full show. You can download segments. You can write a review. You can subscribe. So the next episode will arrive right at your device. How exciting is that?
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah La, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Points, 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 points. Canadians are ridiculous about points, and points programs encourage you to spend. That is the entire point of participating in points. But if you're in debt, you should probably not be spending, at least not so much. So you have to navigate the points programs while at the same time whittling down your balance. Vanessa Bowen is the founder of Mintworthy. She is here to talk about how we can find this balance, how we can use points while also combating debt. Hello, Vanessa.
Hello, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Should someone who is carrying debt even consider collecting points? And my starting point is no, 1,000 times no, but I am willing to be convinced. Go.
Okay, you're going to hate me, but I'm going to say absolutely.
I'm not going to hate you. I'm not going to hate you. I could never hate you.
So my take is absolutely yes. So for me, collecting points is about being money smart. And I truly believe if you put out a dollar, you should be rewarded for it. And honestly, it's personal for me because I actually leveraged loyalty programs and collected points to help me get out of debt faster. Because you rack up those points, you redeem them, you know, you can manage your monthly expenses, reduce those expenses, and have more cash left over at the end of the month and put that cash towards your debt. So I'm 100% saying yes, points is the way to go.
So how did you, and I'll ask you the personal question first, how did you ensure that you didn't overspend? Because a lot of people go in and they overspend because they want to qualify for some extra points. And there's this and there's that, and there's buy two and earn extra 500. My background's marketing. I know how this works. It is very simple to influence buyer behavior by giving them a very insignificant reward. How did you navigate it yourself?
Yeah, the key here is you have to have a plan. So you shouldn't use points without a budget. So I had like a strict budget. I knew where my money was going. And the points was to supplement my debt repayment strategy. Like it wasn't like my full strategy. It was just a way to put more money towards my debts to get out of the debt faster. So I would say your budget has to be first, sticking to your spending plan and not focusing on, you know, earning those extra few points, because that can be a slippery slope and that can land you more into debt. So your budget, your spending plan have to be priority first.
It also sounds like you're very specific about the points program that you participate in, because a lot of people are in some sort of airline points program, right? So they're building these air miles and at some point they want to take a trip. It just doesn't sound like you did that. Did you do a cashback card or something?
Yeah, I'm more focused on cashback. And I think that's the biggest thing is you have to find a rewards program that gives you rewards that you're actually going to use. And if the focus is getting out of debt, I definitely recommend like a cashback type of thing where you can redeem for, you know, your monthly expenses, have more cash in your pocket, and then put that towards your debts.
How do you think about redeeming those points when you're carrying debt? So you earn them, you earn them, you earn them. And then when it comes time to use them, is it groceries or a new mascara?
I mean, I wish it was a new mascara, but at the time it was groceries. That was where I focused. And I always say, like, pick one of your typical monthly purchases and use the points to redeem against that. So my strategy, I would rack up the points. I'd redeem them for, you know, groceries. And then in my grocery budget, because I had my budget. So let's say my budget was $500. I redeemed, got $100 off, let's say. So I took that extra $100 in the budget and put that towards the debt. So I think think you need to have like a simple approach, like a simplicity way of doing it. Don't try to redeem for any and everything.
How many points programs should the average person carrying debt have?
So I don't think there's a magic number. Personally, I say you want to at least have an everyday account that earns you points wherever you spend, and then have like loyalty cards at the places that you typically shop at. You know, points, they do add up. So if you are going to shop at a place multiple times a year, I think it's worth having that program so at least you can be rewarded for that spending.
One of the tips for people dealing with debt is to have them use cash only. And I have been talking about this for 12,000 years. And if not cash, then at least a debit card, which can fly in the face of the points mentality. How do you deal with that?
So again, like if you are serious about becoming debt-free, like you have to have a budget, you have to have a plan for your money. So if you've built up that habit of being disciplined and know how to stick to your plan, I think you can get away with using a credit card that earns you points. Now, some people might be scared to, you know, have the extra credit. So you can always leverage, you know, everyday accounts that still give you some point ability to earn. So for instance, you know, the PC Money account, you can earn points with that. If you're okay with having a credit card, then you just have a lower limit. Don't let it be like a $10,000 credit card for you to spend crazy. Just lower the limit and know it's just for my everyday spending. But the key is to stick to your budget so that you don't overspend and get yourself into more debt.
Everyday spending and the occasional bottle service, right?
Yes.
Is that what you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's it.
You talk about double or triple dip, and I assume you are not talking about a Dairy Queen soft serve cone here. Tell me about triple dip in the context of points.
Yes. So what I mean by that is if you have an everyday account that earns you points for, you know, every dollar you spend anywhere, that's your first dip. Then you shop at a specific place that has a loyalty program. Make sure you have that card so you second dip. And then if you are going to purchase online, you can use something like Rakuten where you get even more cash back. So then you triple dip. So I always say, if I'm going to spend a dollar, like how can I be rewarded for this $1 as many times as I possibly can? So it's more bang in my buck.
This is your world. You focus on it in your work. You have lived experience here having walked this path. There are some people who simply are unable for a variety of reasons to walk the balance that we're talking about. So, you know, having a card and accumulating points and all that stuff. How does one know if they are one of those people? You know, it's kind of, and this may be an unfair connection, but there are some people who are perfectly fine having a glass of wine and other people who need to have zero glasses of wine.
I think you have to know who you are. I think that's the key. It's knowing who you are and knowing what your boundaries are. Like if you know you're going to be tempted to spend or to have that glass of wine, like it's knowing, okay, these are my boundaries. And so I'm not going to engage in a strategy that I know it's going to get me into more of an issue.
The other dynamic that we haven't really talked about, what we probably should, is with many of these points programs that are connected to a card, there is a hard inquiry on your credit score, right? Like if you apply for every card, which by the way, in university, I totally did because they gave away free pens. And I would do almost anything for a free pen or a free t-shirt. I have learned my lesson here, but can you give us the note of caution? It's one thing to get like a little punch card at your local coffee shop and earn for free lattes. It's another thing to have a wallet full of credit cards that may well denigrate your score.
Totally agree. And that's why I say like one everyday card. So whether it's one credit card, like that's it. You don't need, you know, the whole gambit of them. It's only one, only use that for your spending. You don't need five cards for your everyday spending. It's going to make it even harder to manage your budget that way. So I always say just do one and find the one that's going to give you the rewards that you're actually going to use. And that's it.
And that is it. Vanessa, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Vanessa Bowen is the founder of Mintworthy. We were talking about how to walk this really hard line between earning points and not overspending. And Vanessa does make a good point. She made many good points, but one of them was you can use those points for groceries, and that's good to reduce your spending.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later on the show, we'll talk to Sammy Dweck. He is with the family office doctor to talk to your kids about their inheritance, like if they get one. I don't know. It's kind of an exciting and terrifying topic. But first, Jessica Robinson is here. She's going to talk about her book, Financial Feminism, A Woman's Guide to Investing for a Sustainable Future. She's worked in sustainable finance for most of her career. She's got a really, really interesting, interesting take on this topic and some very helpful tips.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Financial feminism. I love this phrase. I love this phrase because I love alliteration, but I also love it because it puts a very sharp focus on one of the most intractable challenges in personal finance, gender inequality. My next guest says empowering women to invest their wealth in very particular ways will not only lead to a more equitable future, but a more sustainable one too. Jessica Robinson is the author of Financial Feminism, A Woman's Guide to Investing for a Sustainable Future. She joins us now to talk more about the book and how you can invest this way. She is in Dubai. Hello there.
Hi. Nice to be on the call.
We have talked about gender in investing on this show for a number of years. We've talked about the pay equity gap. We've talked about all of these things, and not to say that we could ever talk about them enough, but what you bring to the table is a unique perspective, and that is the intersection of gender, and as you call it, financial feminism, and sustainable investing. What happens at that intersection?
So, as you said, absolutely, this discussion around gender pay gap, investing gap is really significant. But I do feel that we're almost missing a beat when we talk about financial feminism, which is around the equality of women and the financial equality of where they sit. I think it's really important that actually we extend this. So to me, financial feminism is really about women using their wealth to create the kind of world that they want to live in. It's about aligning those investment decisions we have with our values. And so it's not really just about women earning and investing on a par with men. To me, it really represents that opportunity for women to use their financial power to build and create positive change in the world.
You have worked in sustainable investing for a long time. What was the moment when you saw that you needed to talk about it differently?
So yes, I've been in sustainable finance, sustainable investing for a very long time. Makes me an old timer. And I was really struck by the number of women that would come up to me and talk around, wow, this is important. So I'd speak at a conference and they'd come up to me afterwards and say, what can I do in my personal financial situation, my investments as a retail investor? And so I started doing a lot of research and actually found some data which indicated that women genuinely are, they're motivated to think about impact and sustainability beyond purely financial returns. And to me, then it was like a light bulb. It was, okay, there is something in this. At the same time, you've got women earning and owning a much greater significant portion of that wealth. But also, many women feel completely disengaged with the financial industry. They simply feel they're not being served by financial advisors or their banks or their asset managers. So it was sort of everything coming together at once to really actually say, look, there's something in financial feminism that's not just about financial equality. It's actually about that opportunity for change for women to use their investment decisions for that change.
Your introduction reads differently than almost any other personal finance book I have ever read, and I've read them all. You say, at the end of this book, quote, I want to give you goosebumps when you think of how smart you can be. I love the line. I love the image. What did you mean by that?
I believe in the power of the sisterhood. And I think that sisterhood has to touch on every aspect of our lives. And I think that we talk quite often about women as consumers. We talk about women as being at the political table, company directors, but everything we do about our money and the investment choices we make is a lever of change. It's a vote for something that we want to do better. And I'm inspired by the amazing women around the world, but I do feel the financial and investment industry is so male dominated. I think we need to shake it up. I think we need to talk about the purpose of capital. I think we need to have deep philosophical conversations around the future that we want to build. And I think women are going to drive that conversation.
How literal do you take the phrase financial feminism in terms of specific investments in the broader realm of ESG that focus on women? So for example, I'm going to make one up. Microfinance in developing countries that focus on the matriarch. Is it that linear, or is it, no, we love a good wind farm. Wind farms are good.
No. It's not linear at all. It is saying to every woman who is making an investment decision, you have power over what you believe in. And if it's climate change, if it's sustainable fashion, if it's microfinance, those are choices that you make, and you align your choices with your values and your priorities. So for me, as example, I'm an environmental economist. Every investment I want to do will not touch fossil fuels. That's my empowerment. That's my moment saying, I'm sorry, this is what I believe in. I want to get my money into clean tech, renewables. This is what I want to do, and I'm going to do it intelligently and consciously. So I think, we sort of dumb it down when we talk about women wanting to think about microfinance or whatever. This is not what we're talking about. We're talking about transformational change in our capital markets, essentially.
Sustainable investing as a approach, even as an asset class, has been around for a fairly long period of time. And yet there are a lot of people who are still not quite sure what that is. Where would you recommend our listeners get started, or how should they get started?
You mean aside from my book?
Aside from your book, in addition to your book, and your book gives some great suggestions, right? Mutual funds, yeah. ETFs, angel investing.
I mean, there are so many opportunities out there. And the thing that's happened in the last couple of years is that we are now having mainstream discussions around ESG and sustainability. I mean, I've been in the field for many years, and I've been knocking on doors and saying this matters. And finally, we have asset managers, banks coming and saying, yes, you're right. And we have regulators and governments, right? So the good thing is there's a lot of information out there now. So it's about being educated, about being empowered. I always recommend women, well, and men as well, that they focus on the key issues. They look at the research. They look at what the NGOs and the think tanks are doing. They look at regulatory frameworks. It's all out there. My biggest word of caution is around the greenwashing that I think is one of the potential risks that we have coming up. Now it seems to be the sort of the trend of the moment. We need to ensure, particularly as retail investors, as individuals, we need to ensure there's transparency and accountability in the market. So
is your money genuine? Yes. Where is the line for you on greenwashing? Can you see it? Is it abundantly clear to you? As a trained eye?
It's challenging. Thankfully, we're getting more data and we're getting a lot more technology supports that transparency, but it is challenging. I often recite a pension fund that I'm invested in, and one of the top, I'm in a green fund, and one of the top investments actually a large American investment bank that is a big financier of fossil fuel development in Southeast Asia. And I'm an expert of what I do, and I didn't realize I was invested in that. So I think we really need to talk about it more. We need to push financial advisors and the banks, the retail banks and the asset managers. And we need to support NGOs that are shining spotlights on what's actually going on. I do think it is a worry. The greenwashing issue is a worry. We're rushing to the market. Thankfully, it is improving with regulatory focus as well, though.
We have listeners who are women and have complete control over their finances because they're single or they're married to another woman or whatever. We also have listeners who, for whatever their life path has taken, they're married to men. And we know that there are so many things that can complicate those partnerships, gender being one of them. If you were to give one single piece of advice to a woman who was married to a man who saw the light, who felt the goosebumps and wanted to or needed to exert her voice or make her voice known in the very microcosm of that relationship, what would you say?
I would actually probably say do your research. And this is not sustainable investing in ESG is not about philanthropy or charity. Mm. If you want to appeal to your partner, talk about risk and talk about opportunity. The very fact is we now are coming together on climate change. This is the most singular significant risk to our financial markets. So take that information and have an intelligent conversation around risk and opportunities. This is not a nice to have. This is a sensible way forward with your investment portfolio.
Jessica, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Jessica Robinson is the author of Financial Feminism, A Woman's Guide to Investing for a Sustainable Future. We just cracked the surface of it. There's just tons and tons of great insight in this book, including lots of primer insight on the world of investing, but through this through the sustainability and gender lens. So pick it up, find it. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, we're going to broaden the family conversation out here to talk about how you discuss family wealth with your children. And clearly there are haves and have-nots, right? But for those who have, they have a challenge on how they deal with multi-generational wealth and how to talk to their kids about that. Sammy Dweck is our guest. To stay up to date on all things Moolala, it is very simple. We have a newsletter. It is free. Once a month, you hear all the stuff that we're doing here on SiriusXM, in my columns on CBC Radio, Cityline, BNN Bloomberg. If you sign up, it comes to you once a month, and I will never do anything with your email address other than send you a newsletter.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Teaching your kids about money is one thing, like the generic topic, but teaching them about the family money, like your specific income, your specific net worth, and what piece of that they might get one day, that is another thing altogether, especially when there's a lot of it. Discussing family wealth can be uncomfortable. It can have unintended consequences. But my next guest says it is crucial to talk to your kids about their future and their future inheritance. Sammy Dweck is the founder and CEO of The Family Office Doctor. He joins us now to talk about that particular conversation, the risks and the rewards. He's in Delray Beach, Florida. Hello there.
Hey, good morning, Bruce.
Why do you think it is important to talk to your kids about your family's wealth if you were in a privileged position and that is an accurate characterization of your circumstances?
Look, I think it's important to speak to your kids about everything, not just the family wealth, but what's going to happen in the future. Trying to keep them in the dark is a mistake. I mean, let's be very clear. These privileged kids, they're getting out of their fancy cars and their fancy houses. You think that they already don't know that they're privileged. So having that conversation, because you and I, we don't know when something is going to go wrong, right? I don't know if I'll get knocked by a bus. I don't know if a plane will crash. So who's going to tell the kids? Is it going to be your attorney? That's going to be very cold. What if it's a culture shock? And I've had that with a client where they all of a sudden woke up and were exposed to immense wealth, and they didn't know how to deal with it. In fact, they went off the deep end. They went from being very frugal to being exceptionally frivolous, and those are dangers.
At what age is this conversation appropriate? And I bet you're going to answer this. It's not one and done. I bet you're going to tell me it unfolds over time. But tell me, like, what? How do you think about it? Is this like the big chat at age 18, or is it, no, we have minor conversations at age 10, and then we show them the family balance sheet at age 29.
Yeah, look, first of all, you got to look at each of your children because everyone's different. Their capacity to understand is different. Their involvement, their interests are different. So it's doing it in a manner that you can connect to them. Don't just blurt it out on them. I think it'll be too much, right? So yes, it is a series of conversations. It may be, hey, you know what, Bob? I'm going to give you an allowance, and I want to see how you manage that money, right? And you could start that at 13. You're going out with your friends for Starbucks. Okay, giving you $100. Let's see how you deal with that $100 and how you spend it.
That's a lot of Starbucks, $100. Jeez, I could get coffee
Starbucks
for the whole
pretty expensive. Probably
okay, you're right.
That many.
That's a venti latte and two cake pops. That's pretty much all you get, right?
So again, it's a series of conversations where you're starting to expose them, right? And it can be through many different manners. So in my specific case, my initial exposure to investments was at my bar mitzvah. Someone gave me shares in Cadbury Schweppes. And I was 13. It's like, what the hell are shares and what's Cadbury Schweppes? Well, Cadbury's I knew. And I was 14. I got on the train. I went from Manchester to London for the AGM, the annual general meeting. And that was my first exposure of being a shareholder and shareholders' rights. I was 14. Mm. Okay. Now, I'm not saying all 14-year-olds are aware. But now with the internet, they're a lot more aware of the markets and stock markets and everything else. So start having those gentle conversations. What's a checking account? What's a savings account? What's an equity? They're not stupid.
And families do this very, very differently in terms of not only how they talk about money, but also how they set up their estate plan. So in a lot of families, that money is not ever available in full to the children necessarily. If you've signed the giving pledge and you're, you know, one of Buffett's kids or Zuckerberg's kids, you're not getting the full amount, but also how that comes to them. So maybe they'd get an amount at 18, maybe they wouldn't get the balance until age 30. How detailed should you be with your kids about, listen, this is what the glide path looks like?
Well, look, in the case where kids have this expectation of, oh, you know, mommy and daddy made a lot of money, I'm set. I think you should set expectations of, hey, buddy, maybe you're not going to get anything, right? I think it's important they know that. And honestly, my personal opinion, you want to keep them hungry. You want them to be the next Gates. You want them to be the next Zuckerberg. You don't want to kill that flame. You want to keep it lit. You want to help them forwards. This should be a nest egg of, in case something goes wrong, not live off it and go be a trust fund baby.
Shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves is an expression that in your world, I'm sure is, a very common occurrence for you to bring this idea up. And basically it's that wealth is created and in three generations, it can disappear. What do you believe works in reducing the likelihood that that will be the legacy of a family's multi-generational wealth?
Communication is the top one. Mm. I mean, talking, being open to one another. One of the biggest problems I find is families with immense wealth think that it's a great idea to not share things with their kids or just to tell them what they should do and how they should do things. I've decided you're going to be a doctor. You're going to go to school and that's what you're going to be, or you're going to be a lawyer. So listen to your kids. Try to understand who they are. Have conversations. I'm not saying don't be a parent. Be a parent. But try and encourage them on their path. Let them find their way, but have open discussions, family meetings, very, very important. Kids of wealthy families have the biggest issue that most kids don't, getting out of the shadow of mommy and daddy. It's really, really hard. People don't understand the pressure that puts on them, that they need to be better than dad. No, please don't be better than dad. Be the best version of you. Dad's him. You can't be him. You'll never be him. Let's just make you the best version of you. That's how you're going to make them successful.
The other dynamic that wealthy families have, and this can be a real burden for kids, is control. You don't have any money. Parents don't. It's like, what are you going to do? You got to go make your money, go study what you want in school, go work whatever job you want, because there's no lever there. For wealthy families, there is certainly a risk that either articulated or unarticulated views of what the right path is in life will add a significant layer of tension in that family dynamic. How do you help people? How do you help families deal with that?
So again, this is where family meetings are just so important. Having someone come in, a professional like myself, where we mediate them. We make sure each side is being heard. It's amazing how you can put people in the room and they talk at each other, not to each other. So the parents think that they're doing in your best interest and the kids feel intimidated to tell their parents, it's not what I want. This is not what I want to do. You need to get them to a feeling of comfort that they can come out to their parents and say, but dad, I don't want to be a lawyer, right? This is not what I want to do. This doesn't interest me. or don't push me in this way because you'll push me away, right? And so sometimes having that third ear, that outsider who has no skin in the game, but to ensure they're communicating, it all comes down to communication, right? You can have the best planning in the world, but if the communication isn't there, I can tell you, I'll guarantee you, it's going to end badly.
Mm. You know, it is hard for those of us who don't live in those circles to really understand the burden that these families have, but I don't want to minimize it or mock it because those are real challenges.
Look, it's amazing. I've had, unfortunately, to live through a couple of occasions where kids have committed suicide because they couldn't take the pressure. It's to that level, right? It's the lack of trust of people around you. Are they really my friend? Do they really care about me? Or is it because I can pay for the meal or I'll take them out to a party or to a club or to a show? You know, are they there for me? People don't realize that they're living in it's a different world.
Mm. It's a different world. And we appreciate your insight into that world. Sammy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for your time, Bruce.
Sammy Dweck is the founder and CEO of the Family Office Doctor. And our focus was on talking to kids about their inheritance. If you are a family of significant means, that is a tough conversation for you to have, both in communication and how you structure your estate plan. It's a lot. Well, that is our show for today. Thank you to our sponsor, Credit Canada, this country's first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, you can subscribe to our newsletter. It is at moolala.ca. Our podcast is available all over the place. Wherever you listen to them, go there, review it, subscribe. Very simple. And if you have questions, comments, thoughts, ideas, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. On social media, you can find me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us today and have a great night.